To welcome everybody to the post-council meeting. We have some members who have asked to be excused this morning. First is Matt Checkitz. Dr. Checkitz will not be here. Commissioner Gibson has asked to be excused, and Director Stevenson. Deputy Director Sparks will be presenting for Director Stevenson this morning. We have a couple of presentations that we would like to make. So, Kelly, if you come with me to the podium.
We would like to recognize Robbie Robertson and Donna Dillingham Evans, who have served faithfully on the Post Council for, I think, eight years apiece. We certainly appreciate their service and the work and the time and effort that they have donated. This will be their term has expired, and this will be their last meeting with the Council. So we have a small token here for each of you that we'd like to give in honor of your service and to show our appreciation.
I really appreciate the wisdom that both Robbie and Donna brought to the Post Council. I've had the privilege of serving with both for several years, and they were always active participants of the Post Council and always had good input on the heavy matters that are considered by the Post Council. So I, on behalf of law enforcement, would like to thank both of you for your contributions and service to the Post Council and wish you the best. Thank you. We will have new members at our next meeting, which is in March. First would be Dr. Bruce Bailey from Weber State University. Welcome, Dr. Bailey. And the second is Chief Marlon Stratton. Marlon, welcome. Well, you won't have as far to drive the next meeting since we'll be down in the St. George area, so where it's only 32 degrees. Quite a bit warmer than here. So welcome you both to the Post Council, and look forward to years of service and wisdom that you'll both bring to the table. We also have Mr. Stromberg sitting in for Director Cook from the Department of Corrections this morning. Welcome, sir. With that, we'll move to our first agenda item, which is approval of the September 25th minutes.
So moved.
Sheriff Edmonds. Chief Carpenter, all in favor?
Aye.
All right, next will be satellite audits by Lieutenant Brewer of Salt Lake Community College and Utah Valley University.
Thank you, Chairman, Council members. It's good to be with you this morning. As you know, there are eight satellite academies that are currently active in the state of Utah, and the last two for this year, for the calendar year, we performed audits on them. Utah Valley University director is Steve DeMille, and currently they do not have any classes in session. They just barely finished a special function officer class, and they're preparing for a class that begins in January. There were no
exceptions to the audit for Utah Valley University. The next audit we performed was the Salt Lake Community College, and the director there is Dave Attridge. They currently have one law enforcement block in session with 20 students. And they'll be graduating that block in December 12th. And then one special function course is going on right now, and they finished that class on December 7th. So just in a little bit. Actually, I think they're probably finishing that tomorrow. So there's no exceptions to the Salt Lake Community College audit. I would like to just say that during these audits, we typically talk about things that are going on between us and the satellite academies. And a topic of discussion this past about 4 months has been the online application, how that's working, how the students and the cadets and those applicants are going through the process, and it helps us to ferret out any problems, any questions, any concerns that go on. So this was a topic of not so much considerably concern. However, it allows us to then work with them very closely one-on-one and address any concerns they have, and also find out what are their successes. And the online application has been very successful so far. So any questions regarding the Satellite Academy audits or the process? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lieutenant Brewer. We'll next move to our investigation process review by Director Sparks.
Thank you, Chairman Keith, council members. Kind of following up on the conversation that was held in the last post-council meeting, Director Stevenson and I wanted to give the council kind of an overview of our investigations process. The purpose of this report is to give members of the post-council a clearer understanding of the investigative processes that take place at post-investigations prior to a case coming before the council for consideration of sanctions. And I would refer you to the yellow sheet inside your packet for the council members. We'll have a narrative of the report. Utah Code 53.6-11 requires that a chief, a sheriff, or administrative officer notify post if they become aware that a certified employee has violated the code. Most of the complaints that we receive at post come from the employing agency. However, we also receive complaints from time to time from individual officers or from private citizens. When these complaints are received, they are entered by post into a complaint log, and then they go through a preliminary review process by the investigations bureau chief or his assistant. The purpose of the preliminary review is to determine if an investigation should be opened. This screening will include a review of the information received from the referring agency, to include the agency's internal investigation. If the complaint is referred by an individual officer or an individual citizen, the complainant may be also requested to provide a written statement or explanation. If the preliminary review determines that an investigation is warranted, the case is then assigned to a post investigator. Notice of the investigation is then sent to the involved officer and to the employing agency. The assigned post investigator will conduct a complete, thorough, independent investigation. This investigation will include a review of all internal investigative reports, all criminal investigative reports, and any other written documents that are pertinent to the case. The investigator will also interview the involved officer and any witnesses. Officer interviews are always attended by at least two post investigators, and generally a Garrity warning is provided to any certified officer or dispatcher who is interviewed as part of this process. Regular case reviews are conducted throughout the investigation with the investigations bureau chief or his assistant, Lieutenant Acosta. At the conclusion of the investigation, the case is screened with the entire investigation staff and either the director or deputy director of post. At this staffing, a determination is made as to whether or not there is clear and convincing evidence that the accused officer violated Utah Code 53.6-11. If post investigations determines that post could not meet its burden of proof in the case, a letter of no action is issued to the officer and the employing agency is notified. If at staffing a determination is made that post could meet its burden of proof, a notice of agency action is drafted, and that notice is then reviewed by the entire investigation staff. The notice of agency action then becomes the basis for the administrative record, and this is the notice that is the council receives when they are deliberating possible sanctions. The post-investigation staff works hard to ensure that all relevant and pertinent information is included in the notice of agency action. Once the notice has been through this internal review process, it is sent to the director and to the assistant attorney general assigned to posts, currently Mr. Bolander, for their review and comment. Once the notice is reviewed, approved, and we're satisfied that it contains all the pertinent facts of the case, the notice is then served on the accused officer. This process is designed to protect the due process rights of the officer. Once the notice is served on the officer has 30 days to respond. The accused officer may contest the facts outlined in the notice or introduce additional facts in a hearing before an administrative law judge or ALJ. The administrative law judge will consider all of the evidence and testimony presented at the hearing and then render a decision outlining the findings of facts and conclusions of law. Until this point, the information contained in the notice is simply allegations, but this adjudication legally establishes what the facts of the case are. An investigative report, which is not part of the administrative record, may contain some ancillary information. It may contain some unsubstantiated allegations, rumor, even innuendo. However, this information is not included in the notice of agency action because it was not borne out during the investigation. Only the information contained in the notice is considered a fact of record. The accused officer may also waive his right to a hearing before an ALJ. In waiving his right to a hearing, the accused officer admits as true all of the facts, all of the facts contained in the notice of agency action and acknowledges that POST could meet its burden of proof of proving each of the allegations listed in the notice. Again, once a waiver is signed by the officer, the information contained in the notice becomes the legally established facts of the case. Occasionally, an accused officer may simply not respond to the notice of agency action, and in this case, the officer is then notified that his time period for filing a responsive pleading has expired, and an order of default is then processed. When an ALJ signs the order of default, the case moves forward based exclusively on the facts that are contained in the notice of agency action. Once the ALJ has made a decision, or the officer has stipulated to the facts of the case and signed a waiver, or a default has been entered, the matter shall then be presented to the post counsel at their next regularly scheduled meeting. Administrative rule provides that the counsel shall be provided with the documents contained in the administrative file, which includes the notice of agency action and any responsive pleadings from the accused officer, and or the decision that's rendered by the ALJ. The council will also be provided with any written information submitted by the chief, sheriff, or administrative officer of the employing agency. The post council's charge then is to review the matter and determine whether suspension or revocation is appropriate based on the facts of the case and the disciplinary guidelines. The accused officer or his attorney may address the council regarding whether the officer's certification should be suspended or revoked. In addressing the council, the officer should not attempt to dispute, argue, or add to the established facts of the case as contained in the administrative file. The officer may, however, introduce mitigating considerations such as a counseling or treatment program which has been attended since the violation occurred. After the council has had the opportunity to hear the case and deliberate a sanction, a final order is signed by the council chair. A final order becomes effective on the date it's signed. An officer may receive credit toward a period of suspension from the time that he was suspended or from his department or since he was no longer able to act as a peace officer. An officer may obtain judicial review of the council's action by filing a petition for judicial review with the Utah Court of Appeals within 30 days from the time that the final order is issued. It's our hope that this information helps give you a better understanding or a clearer understanding of the process that post-investigations goes through and how this process is outlined in administrative rule and in code. Happy to entertain any questions that the council may have.
Actually, I don't mean to put you on the spot. This is also a question for the council in general. As I read the code, it's not specific to violations of law, but we tend to stick to violations of law with the exception of Garrity violations. But we typically don't review use of force as his body goes. And in fact, I've terminated two employees who have been received statements from the district attorney that says they violated the law, even though he chose not to prosecute them. But yet this council, this body, does not hear those cases typically. Have you been given direction that we're not to look at use of force cases, or why do we shy away from those?
When it has been established that it's a violation of law and that the use of force crosses the line into an assault area, we will investigate and review those cases.
Now, is that specific to the code? Because I have a question for this, because one of the most significant things that we ever do in our careers as administrators is review use of force within our departments, and that goes right to the public trust and confidence that they have in our entire system and process. But yet we set forth standards that say this is how, what we expect during a shooting, this is what we expect with everything else, and we train officers throughout the state, but yet we will not review those use of force cases, which are really, I'm not minimizing anything on this sheet of paper. But the use of force cases are the ones that the public wants to know about, and why are we not doing something to ensure that not only Salt Lake City officers, but officers throughout the states are consistent in their application of force, service of warrants, and some of those other things that, again, walk on that line, but I don't think the statute says it has to be strict violations of law.
Well, as I interpret that, Chief Burbank, as an administrator, if I received a letter from the county attorney or the district attorney indicating that an officer did violate the law, then I have the responsibility to report that to post, during which time they do an investigation. So I'm not sure if you've reported these and post hasn't investigated them, or...
No, they've all been reported.
Well, then, good question. I don't have the answer, Director Sparks.
That's really the crux for us, is whether or not it crosses the line into a violation of law. The code does not specifically state anything about use of force short of a violation of the law. So it's only those cases where we're able to determine through the investigation that there is a clear violation of law, at least clear enough to the point that we feel that the evidence is clear and convincing, that an ALJ would find that there was a violation of law in that use of force. Then we would bring those cases to the close counsel.
Any follow-up,
Chief Burbank?
No, there'll be follow-up after.
Sure, please.
Chairman, I'm unclear on that. So if it's reported by an agency that their district attorney or county attorney has found that a violation of law, that he chose not to prosecute that, and it's submitted to Post, would Post do another investigation or an investigation into that to see whether they can confer with the district attorney?
For all of our cases, post-investigation is an independent process,
right,
independent of what happens in the criminal adjudication.
Right.
There may be many reasons why a county attorney or district attorney declines prosecution. Our investigative efforts are focused on the behavior of the individual officer, and if that behavior constitutes a violation of law, we would bring that forward. And you'll see that many of the cases, even the cases that we have today, there was no criminal prosecution, but those cases are still being brought before the council. So our focus is on, does the behavior constitute a violation regardless of what may have happened in the criminal adjudication?
Mr. Wallentine?
Well, the irony seems to me that we're dealing with an issue here that is addressed at different levels with different standards of proof and different questions to be answered. And it sounds, in response to Chief Burbank's question, it sounds to me that the answer is that unless there is a statutory violation, that Post is not going to act. Yet at the same time, you could have an officer terminated. And I actually think, Chief, that we may have had one in the past that came out of Orem Department of Public Safety. I don't recall where that came.
They're
out.
Few and far between, and
they have
the number that
right. They are terminated. Few and far between. And at the same time, a chief can terminate someone, and the termination's upheld through our Utah court system. you can have a federal civil rights action, and damages are assessed against the chief, the sheriff, the agency, the employing entity, and the individual officer, and yet it would seem then that their certification doesn't get touched and they don't get entered into the, assuming there was a decertification, don't get entered into the national database. Am I correct in that?
Would you just restate your...
Sure. If you follow Chief Burbank's example through, I'm not thinking of a particular case that years ago did come here, you could have an officer where the county attorney has declined to prosecute because of the officer's conduct. The county attorney has, because of the officer's conduct in an arrest, but the county attorney has opined that the officer committed misconduct, but because the National District Attorneys Association has this panoply of standards, which include... incidentally, an alternative remedy for the misconduct in some other form. The county attorney declines to prosecute the officer criminally for the officer's behavior. The chief or sheriff determines that the officer's behavior violates the standards of the agency and terminates the officer. The case goes to our Utah Court of Appeals. And again, I'm thinking very specific. This has happened. Goes to the Utah Court of Appeals. The Utah Court of Appeals upholds the chief's decision to terminate the officer, and then ancillary to that, separate from that, the agency, the chief, the officer are sued in federal district court under Section 1983 of the Civil Rights Act for violating the person's civil rights by using excessive force, and damages are assessed or a settlement's reached. All of that can happen, and yet it seems that I'm hearing that if the officer hasn't committed what Post determines to be a crime, that Post wouldn't take action. And if that's the situation, and I think Chief Burbank, all I'm doing is taking your example.
Yeah,
and
you are.
And taking it to not just its logical extreme, but an extreme that I've seen happen.
Well, unless there's a violation of statute, unless it's a clear violation of 536211, we would have no authority to take action. So in a case where it is a violation of a criminal code, then we would investigate those and bring them before the council if we had the evidence to show by clear and convincing standard that it was a violation.
But if you have a letter to the chief administrative officer indicating that their employee did violate the assault statute, however, that for whatever reason they've chosen not to prosecute because the agency has terminated them, or for whatever reason, surely Post would take that letter that from a prosecuting attorney that said, yes, a violation of the law did occur, and move forward with that investigation for license, censure, or revocation. Is that
absolutely
correct?
Absolutely. If we have an indication that the law has been violated, then yes, definitely we would take that case and we would move forward with it. We will, in a review of those, frequently contact the district attorney or county attorney to determine why it was not adjudicated, why it was not process, whether it was a procedural thing or whether it was the evidence wasn't there. So certainly reviewing that decision is part of the investigative process, but you're absolutely right. If we have indication that it's a violation of law, we will move forward with those cases. Right.
Sheriff Edmonds.
Some of it's been answered, but I want to get it out here. One of the most important, I think, functions of this body is to protect the sanctity of this profession. And there are times when an action could have been deemed criminal in nature, but for whatever reason, it's not prosecuted. There aren't formal charges filed. Our evidentiary standard here is much lower than beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal proceeding. Therefore, I think it's incumbent upon us to be looking at those kinds of cases, making sure that we are protecting the sanctity of this profession, making sure that just because an individual wasn't formally prosecuted, that if there was a clear and convincing evidence that they did commit a crime, that we make sure that they don't, their certification status is affected. I think that's absolutely critical, and I think the chief brings up a good point here.
Well, and I would argue an officer punches somebody and you terminate their employment or you give them sanctions for failing to use appropriate force, that potentially is a violation of the law. Every single time. But yet we are not typically reviewing those. I would actually like to make a motion, if I might, Mr. Chair.
Well, before you do that, Director Sparks, how difficult would it be to give us a historical record of how many of these type of cases have been referred to Post
We can certainly provide that at the next council meeting.
Along with the disposition of what your investigation resulted in?
Certainly.
Which, as Chief Burbank has pointed out, I don't recall too many use of force cases coming before the council either.
I would, if I may, I would just like to make clear, and perhaps I haven't, that if there is a violation of law, as the sheriff said, if we have clear and convincing evidence that there's been any violation of law, we will move forward with those cases and bring those before the post council.
Well, and that assumes, though, that the chief makes the reference to you, and so that's part of that. Chief, that's part of the
assumption. It assumes that we become aware of
the case, whether it becomes aware from the chief or we have it from some other reliable source. It assumes that we know that the case is there. Yes.
Right. Colonel Fuhrer?
They are reviewing those cases, and the reason why I know that is because we had an officer that struck somebody four times in the side. That had a very big public media story. The department was sued from that, and we paid out. They went to a CSRB hearing, and the officer was found to have assaulted the individual. We as a department found that they assaulted the individual and terminated them. We sent the case to post counsel. It was reviewed and determined that there was no violation of the law, and therefore it wasn't going to go forward. So I know that the post counsel is reviewing those cases. It's just a matter of what the chief saying is, when do we get involved in that decision-making process, and when does it come to this body rather than being squashed at a different level? Because I believe you are reviewing those cases when it's turned over.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other discussion before we go back to Chief Burbank for his motion?
Well, I think you took care of my motion, Mr. Chair. I mean, I would just like to see us review those cases and see, because there's, you know, that's absolutely one that I want to know, and I've got several that I know personally through my agency. That, again, our purpose is not to slam officers for what they do, but our purpose is to hold people accountable and make sure that as a profession throughout this state that we are, in fact, taking care of the public and making sure that we hold officers accountable for their inappropriate actions.
Absolutely. Director Sparks, would it be possible for you to complete this review and get the information out to the council prior to our next meeting?
Certainly.
So we'll have that and have a week or so to review it prior to our next meeting, and then we can discuss
Certainly.
It rather than taking the time to actually sit down and read the document.
Yeah, we'll be happy to do that. We'll look at our complaint log and at the investigations log and provide a report to the council.
All right. Sheriff Tracy.
I have one more point for discussion if it's time to do that.
Sure.
On the third paragraph on your special report to post counsel, the ending sentence of that that paragraph, if the complaint is referred by an individual officer or citizen, the complainant may be requested to provide a written statement or explanation. My question, or for point of discussion, is this. Why would we not make that a shall instead of may and required instead of requested as a due process issue for the protection of the officers? As we all know, we can receive spurious complaints that come in for an ulterior motive. But when somebody puts that in writing, then it makes them more accountable for that based on if there is a finding that this was a malicious type of a submission.
And you are right. And we normally do that. Our normal procedure is to request that any complaint like that comes in writing. The only exception to that would be if we have information from another source. If we get the complaint and the person hasn't submitted it in writing, we will still make contact with the chief of that agency and inquire about that complaint. And if the chief says, yes, we have that complaint, we're investigating it, we'll give you a report, in those cases we may not require the complainant to fill out a complaint form.
So if an individual came in specifically to post first and made that complaint, you would request to have that in writing?
Yes. Yeah. Unless we had good documentation supporting that from some other source.
Credit Chair. Any further discussion on the topic brought up by Chief Burbank? Okay, I would like to echo what Mr. Wallentine said, though, and these investigations oftentimes post is at the mercy of reporting agencies and the responsibility of the chief or the sheriff to report misconduct to post for investigations. I think that at times in the past there's been struggles getting that to be consistent throughout the state, something I know POST has been trying to rectify through training for administrators on a statewide basis.
Well, don't we have a hammer for that in the statute? Isn't there a requirement that that
there is.
There could be some action brought.
There is. Okay.
Would you like me to go on with the investigations?
You're on the hot seat, so you might as well just consider it.
Thank you. I'm feeling it. The first case before the council today is Russell B. Hill. The offense is cruelty to animals, Category E. Post is recommending a six-month suspension of Officer Whittle certification. On June 16, 2012, Russell B. Whittle's small dog was attacked and killed by a pit bull. In an attempt to free his dog, Whittle struck the pit bull on the head with his fist and then swung the pit bull into a wall until the pit bull dropped Whittle's dog. After the pit bull dropped the dog from its mouth, Whittle grabbed the pit bull and swung it into the side of the garage wall. The pit bull was later euthanized at the owner's request. On August 9, 2012, the owner of the pit bull contacted the local police agency to send an animal control officer to investigate the incident. Whittle was charged with cruelty to animals, a Class B misdemeanor. On March 12, 2013, Whittle entered into a diversion agreement and was required to pay restitution to the victim. Whittle failed to fulfill the diversion agreement, and a warrant was issued. Whittle did not respond to the notice of agency action. On October 2, 2013, a motion for entry of default was mailed to Whittle. Whittle did not respond to the motion for entry of default. And on October 23, 2013, an order of default was signed by the administrative law judge. Whittle did not respond to the order of default.
Is Mr. Whittle or the representative for Mr. Whittle here today that would like to speak? Okay, bring it back to the council for a motion.
I move to accept the recommendation to post the six-month suspension.
Okay. We have a motion by Director Wallentime and second by Mr. Talley. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye. I need to recuse myself from that.
Thank you, Mr. Stumberg.
Thank you.
Second case is Eli Ernst. The offense is theft, Category D. Post is recommending a one-year suspension. On January 26, 2013, Eli Ernst and three other officers attended a party in connection with their secondary employment as security officers. During the party, one of the officers broke into a locked storage room. Ernst and each of the other officers removed a bottle of alcohol for themselves. The theft was discovered after a routine inventory and confirmed via security cameras. When confronted about the missing alcohol, Ernst and the other three officers admitted to the theft and returned the unopened bottles. On February 22, 2013, Ernst resigned from his department. Officer Ernst waived a hearing before the administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts of the case as contained in the notice of agency action.
Is Mr. Ernst or a representative here today that would like to address the council? Did you want to address the council, sir? All right, thank you. Bring it back to the council for a motion.
Motion to accept the suspension.
Okay, motion by Colonel Fuhrer, second by Mr. Robertson. Any discussion on the motion? Mr. Stromberg will recuse himself. All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
The next case is Kyle J. Peterson. The offense is theft, and it's a Category D violation. Post is recommending a one-year suspension. On January 26, 2013, Kyle J. Peterson and three other officers attended a party in connection with their secondary employment as security officers. During the party, one of the officers broke into a locked storage room. Peterson and each of the other officers removed a bottle of alcohol for themselves. The theft was discovered after routine inventory and confirmed via security cameras. When confronted about the missing alcohol, Peterson and the other three officers admitted to the theft and returned the unopened bottles. On February 22, 2013, Peterson resigned from his department. Officer Peterson waived a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts of the case as contained in the notice of agency action.
Is Mr. Peterson here, or representative?
I'm here.
Sir, do you want to address the council?
No, thank you.
All right, we'll bring it back to the council for a motion. Okay, motion by Mr. Robinson. Do we have a second?
Second.
Motion seconded by Sheriff Tracy. Any discussion?
Once again, just excuse
myself. Mr. Stromberg will recuse himself. All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Director?
Next case is Kendrick J. Hawks. The violation is theft, Category D violation, and Post is recommending a one-year suspension. On January 26, 2013, Correctional Officer Kendrick Hawks was working security at a party in Park City in connection with his secondary employment. The party was being held for all employees, and three of Hawks' co-workers, also officers, were in attendance. During the party, one of the officers broke into a locked storage room. Each of the officers removed a bottle of alcohol for themselves. Instead of stopping the theft, Hawks also selected a bottle of alcohol and asked the officers to take his bottle and give it to him at a later time. The theft was discovered after a routine inventory and confirmed via security cameras. When confronted about the missing alcohol, Hawks and the other officers admitted to the theft and returned the bottles. On February 22nd, Officer Hawks resigned from his department. Officer Hawks waived a hearing before an administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
Is Mr. Hawks here today, our representative? Sir, do you want to address the council? All right, we'll bring it back to the council for a motion. Move to accept by Ms. Dillingson. You have a second?
Second.
Chief Carpenter. Recluse by Mr. Stromberg. All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
The next case is Patrick Donegan. The violation is falsification or alteration of government records, a Category E violation, and Post is recommending a one-year suspension. On October 5th, 2011, Patrick Donegan's supervisor became aware Donegan had several traffic stops recorded on his daily log for the month of September 2011 that were not recorded on the dispatch log or on Donegan's video dash camera. During a Department Internal Affairs Garrity interview, Donegan admitted he entered traffic stops and created warnings on his log when he did not actually make the stops. Donegan also admitted he stopped vehicles where two individuals were in a single vehicle. He would write warnings to both individuals, but his log would reflect two separate vehicle stops. Post made several attempts to contact Donegan for an interview. On October 2, 2013, a motion for entry of default was mailed to Patrick Donegan. Donegan failed to respond to the motion for entry of default on October 23, 2013. An order of default was signed by the administrative law judge.
Is Mr. Donegan a representative here today? All right, we'll bring it back to the council for a motion.
Accept.
Burbank, for a second.
I'll second.
Mr. Robinson.
Myself.
Thank you, Colonel. Okay, we have a motion. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Director.
The next case is John Gardner. The offense is driving while ability impaired by alcohol. It's a Category D violation, and Post is recommending a one-year suspension. On August 21st, 2011, John Gardner was stopped by a law enforcement officer for speeding while riding his motorcycle in Colorado. After smelling the odor of alcohol, the Colorado officer had Gardner perform standardized field sobriety tests and provide a breath sample for a portable breath test unit. The results of the PBT indicated a blood alcohol concentration of 0.067. Gardner was arrested and transported to a hospital where he voluntarily provided a blood sample for analysis. The result of the blood sample was 0.073. Gardner was subsequently cited for driving while impaired by alcohol and speeding. Gardner subsequently pled guilty to reckless driving. Gardner did not respond to the notice of agency action, and on November 20, 2013, an order of default was signed by the administrative law judge.
Any questions for Director Sparks?
Haven't we typically done a two-year suspension for DUI, and how is that different?
Most of our DUIs without an aggravating circumstance have been 1 year suspension.
Mr. Wallentine?
Is the investigator who performed this investigation available this morning?
Yes.
Did the investigator look at this particular officer's prior disciplinary history involving traffic incidents?
Sorry, I missed the question. If you could repeat that.
Did you look into the prior history of incidents with this officer, specifically traffic-related, traffic stops, where he was the person stopped and dealt with a police officer, or complaints about his conduct during a traffic stop?
With regard to him being stopped or him being the enforcement officer?
Both.
Not into his enforcement actions, but just specifically regarding his traffic record. And he didn't have exceptionally large history, nothing that showed on the Utah side.
I'm asking about other states, specifically Wyoming.
Nothing that was shown to me from what we ran record-wise. And criminal history-wise, he didn't have any prior events where he had been arrested, cited, or stopped a week prior to driving under the influence.
Did you look at his prior conduct as a trooper with respect to whether he had a disciplinary history?
I did, yes.
Did that impact your decision to make a 1 year recommendation?
Not
or director, maybe that's a question for you. Whether the prior disciplinary history was considered as a possible aggravating factor?
We have not typically used prior departmental disciplinary action as an aggravating circumstance in our recommendations. If they've had previous post-counsel disciplinary action, we will use that as an aggravating circumstance. But we have not used, in the past, have not used departmental discipline as a enhancement to the sanction we recommend.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Director Sparks? Is Mr. Gardner a representative here this morning? All right, I'll bring it back to counsel for a recommendation. Mr. Wallentine?
I move that we reject the recommendation of post for a 1 year suspension and move that the council impose an 18 month suspension.
I get the sense that there's more to the story that you're privy to, Mr. Wallentine.
Well,
it'd perhaps be better to hand this back to post staff for further.
I'll give you a substitute motion. I move that we reject the recommendation of 1 year and ask that we remand this back to post staff with instructions to take a close look at prior history. And I'm happy to have one of my investigators speak with your staff as to where they might go looking.
Second.
Is that you, Sheriff?
That was me.
All right, Sheriff. Any discussion on the motion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Director Sparks, this is back to you. We'll see you in 3 months.
The next case is Timothy K. Jones. Offense is assault, Category C violation. Post is recommending a 2 year suspension. Post investigations investigated Mr. Jones and sustained several allegations. On October 3rd, 2013, an administrative hearing was conducted. The administrative law judge ruled that Post met its burden of proof regarding only the first assault, which occurred on April 11th, 2010, wherein Mr. Jones assaulted a male after forcing him to stop his vehicle. The male filed a police report but declined to press criminal charges. All other allegations were dismissed by the administrative law judge.
All right, is Mr. Jones, our representative here today, that would like to address the council?
If I may address the council.
Sir, if you could state your name and.
I'm Blake Osler. I'm here with Mr. Jones today. I'm a member of the firm of Thompson, Osler & Olson.
If I may address the esteemed council members for just a moment, I'd like to put this into some context.
All right, Mr. Elsler, you'll have 20 minutes. This is what we usually provide council.
I appreciate that. When I was sworn in as an attorney, the esteemed judge from the Federal District Court reminded us that the purpose of the law was to keep folks from going out at high noon and having to shoot it out to determine whether they could resolve their disputes. The context of this particular matter is very important because, given the justly high standards that we demand of officers in this state and protecting the integrity of the profession, we still have to take into consideration the fact that officers are not merely human, but they have lives outside of what they do. This is an action that took place outside of regular duties. More important than that, I think it's important for the council to take into consideration the very high rate of marital failure for its officers and the stress that's placed on them in the context of being an officer. I don't know that this added, but this context is extremely important for your consideration. In 2010, Mr. Jones discovered that his wife was having an affair with another individual. They were separated for a while, but they had come back together and were attempting a reconciliation. His wife had agreed to reconcile to the best that they could, if they could. During that course, she continued to receive phone calls from her would-be suitor, and he asked this individual numerous times by telephone and otherwise not to speak with his wife because she had agreed to attempt a reconciliation. He was present when she herself asked this individual not to become involved in the relationship and to step back to give them a chance to reconcile. He continued to call, continued to pester, and refused to back off. We used to have a claim in this state for alienation of affections. That's no longer recognized by this state. So the question becomes, what does an individual do reasonably when a person refuses to back off, is interfering in the most important relationship in their life, and you can't get their attention? What my client did, I'm not here to excuse what he did, but to place it into a context so that you can consider what would be appropriate under the circumstances. So in April of 2010, keeping in mind that, you know, we're 3 years ago is what we're talking about, nearly three and a half, he got in his car. He was going to go discuss this matter with this individual to ask him not to continue to interfere in the relationship that he had with his wife. While he was on the way driving to the individual's place of residence, he passed him on the street. He turned around to catch up with him so that he could have the conversation with him. He got out of his car. At that point, it's not disputed what happened, and Officer Jones was completely forthcoming as to what happened. He got out. He was extremely angry. He yelled at him and asked him to leave his wife alone. When the individual stated that he had no intention of doing so, he reached through the window and attempted to hit him. It's undisputed that he didn't do so. It's undisputed that he didn't make contact. It's also undisputed that the window was down. I want to place that into some context, too, because it's very clear he could have very easily opened the door if he had a clear intention of doing harm. He could have opened the door and dragged the individual out of the car. He's an officer. He has access to firearms. There was no threat of use of a firearm. There was no use of a firearm. And the kind of force that he did use to get his attention, while I don't condone it, has to be taken into consideration, because what do you do when a person won't back off from interfering with your relationship with your wife? It's imperative. And there were children involved as well. It's important to know. And so he was doing the best that he could to preserve his relationship. Now, what that means, as far as I can see, the hearing officer appropriately found by clear and convincing evidence, because we really didn't contest that this had occurred, that this is a violation of law, this is an assault. But the question becomes, what do we do with an officer when an officer, understandably, outside of the context of being an officer, is involved in a domestic dispute of this nature? A recommendation's been made for a two-year suspension, and of course that two-year suspension would run from October 2011, I believe, when he was placed on suspension from active duty. And so if I'm not mistaken, under the guidelines, that's the two-year suspension, would already be served. I would ask the council, however, to be more lenient with him under the circumstances and to take into consideration two things. The inordinately high rate of marital failure among your officers. This is a very trying profession. And the question is, what do we do to assist them? And you have outreach programs with your officers to assist them with their marital relationships, because this is not a new problem and you're all aware of it. The second thing is, very important, what do we do when the law doesn't provide any kind of a remedy for very, very important interest? What do we do to get a person's interest when they absolutely refuse to listen? His action, while inappropriate, was nevertheless restrained. I'd like you to take that into consideration and suggest that you reject the recommendation for a suspension and not suspend at all, or recommend that the suspension be recognized as having been fully served and that there be no further discipline of any nature whatsoever. Thank you for taking the time to listen to us. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Does council have any questions, Mr. Osler or Mr. Jones?
What was the time frame of suspension that he's been suspended?
He was suspended in October of 2011 and has been suspended. He was also terminated from his employment as a result. He's not employed as a peace officer at this time, but I don't know if that he would like to be reemployed. If he could reapply and become employed as a highway patrolman again, he'd very much like to be able to find employment. He's currently working at Kmart, the Walmart. Don't want to confuse those two. Currently working at Walmart at a minimum wage job, or just above minimum wage. It's not sufficient to sustain a family. And while I recognize that officers are paid what they deserve, given the kinds of service that they provide and the dangers that they face, nevertheless, it's more than what he can make given a revocation and or suspension. So that's a very important interest for him, and he'd like to become reemployed immediately if he could find a position.
All right. Thank you, sir. Director Sparks, turn the time back to you.
I would just point out that our records indicate that Mr. Jones was terminated December 29th, 2011, and that's the day that we would calculate his suspension time from.
Council have any questions for Director Sparks? All right. I'll go back to council for a motion. I'll rephrase. Bring the matter back to council for a motion. Well, this is a first for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I can hear.
Mr. Bollander, what do we do?
Sir. I'd also like to point out, given your prior discussion, this is one of those cases where there was no criminal action. Nevertheless, it was brought to post. This is precisely the kind of action that Officer Burbank was addressing, I believe, where there's no criminal action. You've got an outside of duty type of a criminal action, not prosecuted because the individual involved has chose not to pursue it anymore. And so this is the kind of action I think that you were looking for as a test case, to look at you know, what happens. Do we get these kinds of things opposed? And the answer is, at least this one got opposed.
Mr. Osler, in the future, would you like to be recognized before you just launch any comments?
While he's up there, I mean, if we're going off the record, would you mind if I ask him a couple questions?
No, go ahead, sir.
Please, Counselor.
Sir.
So, one of the questions that I have that you spoke to is, I mean, it's the fact that our officers are involved in a lot of unfortunate circumstances in their personal life and personal relationship. But when you ask how is an officer to intervene, at no point do I see an avenue of intervention in a relationship of any time as a physical confrontation or even an entitlement to have a conversation to where you could flag somebody down on the road or anything else. And that's where I really struggle with this one a little bit, because that standard that we hold officers to, right, it's the same standard that we hold the public to. And so if I were to say to you today, I'm going to allow this particular officer to have a less suspension of anything else and put him out there. When he goes on the stand to testify in a case very similar to this, right, in which he has been forced to make an arrest, partly because of the law, how legitimate is that when he gets a more lenient treatment than somebody in the public would? Because, again, I don't see an avenue that I have a right to physically detain somebody to force a conversation. Yeah, horrible circumstance. But I don't see where the law provides that I have the ability to detain this person and then have any sort of physical confrontation with them at all.
Two responses. First, the evidence as to what happened in the altercation isn't admissible. You couldn't even get it in, frankly, if he were convicted. And when you don't even have a case, it's not admissible into evidence under numerous rules of evidence. So I don't believe that that's an issue with him testifying as an officer. Second, you're right, I'm not here to condone where an officer confronts another and asserts their right. We used to have an avenue that allowed in the law where you could confront them in a court of law, where it's the appropriate place to do it. But that right's been taken away. We don't even have that anymore. The alienation of affections was done away with in 2007. And so we just don't have a remedy for when somebody's interfering in this very important relationship. Keep in mind, this person had been asked not merely by Officer Jones, but also by his ex-wife, his wife at the time, to cease and desist communication, to stop from interfering in the relationship. And so, you know, the type of action that he took, I think it's extremely understandable, but I'm not suggesting that it excuses it. I'm not here to suggest that officers be held to any lesser standard. You justifiably require a very high standard of officers. But if you're going to demand that officers not be human, if you're going to demand that they not have anybody that they actually care about sufficiently to get in the face of another person and say, please don't interfere in my relationship with my wife, I think you're asking the humanly impossible. We deal day in and day out with human beings, and it's a messy job because human beings are messy types of things. And human relationships between a husband and wife, this family relationship, I mean, you're out all the time. You have your officers out every day confronting domestic relationships because we have a very strong policy in favor of preserving these relationships and especially protecting children in these relationships to the extent we can. And so while my comments weren't intended to condone what Officer Jones did, but to place into context, because I ask you, what would you do? If a person refused to leave your wife alone after your wife has repeatedly asked, and continues to interfere nonetheless, and you're without a remedy. In my view, I'm an ex-boxer. I probably would tell a person, knowing justifiably under the law I can threaten more than I would, I'd probably say, if you don't leave my wife alone, I'm going to punch your face in. That's just me. I can threaten that legally.
I'll certainly take a correction from attorneys, but under Brady and Giglio, because this has become a department action, internal action, you are required to report that in the event that he has any sort of domestic violence.
Oh, it was immediately reported.
So it is. No, but what I'm saying is you report that to the defense in any future cases, and that is admissible because that record is in the department, and we have to tell the defense that in any circumstance that he's involved in that, yes, he's been involved in this and been disciplined.
Not this kind of, no. Even... I would go through the rules of evidence with you, but I'm just telling you it's not admissible. I've tried, every prosecutor in the state's tried to get this kind of evidence in, and this falls way below the standard of any kind of offense that you could bring up. Moreover, it doesn't go to veracity. If it were fraud, you're right, it could be brought up, but this doesn't go to fraud in any way. Ask, and Mr. Wallentine can assist you with that as well.
Well, you're not going to like my answer. Chief Burbank's right. Under Brady, Strickland, and Giglio, this has to be disclosed. Now, you're correct that it's not going to get in the tribunal, but it puts the chief or the sheriff, and ultimately, I suppose, the prosecutor in the position. position of every time there is a similar case of having to report that, and at least in the county where Chief Burbank and I are chiefs, our district attorney, the Sullivan County District Attorney, maintains a list of officers. And I don't know how other counties handle it, but at least in this county, this officer's name would go on a list, and I'm guessing other counties are the same, and then in every case where this officer had a similar situation, that would be disclosed to the criminal defense.
I don't think
a judge is going to admit it, but it still creates an issue for that chief or that sheriff, and that's one of the reasons I think the law allows the chief or the sheriff a decision to make termination and discipline decisions.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not suggesting it doesn't have to be disclosed. It absolutely is not admissible into evidence. Any trier of fact considering it's not going to be able to consider it. And again, I'm not here condoning the conduct. I want to place it into context and ask, in this kind of a context, where we have an officer who has a very justifiable interest that he wants to protect, goes about it in a way that is perhaps, well, not perhaps, it goes over the line. But the question is, what's the discipline that's appropriate now? The finding has been made by clear and convincing evidence that he engaged him, and it wasn't disputed, and he reported it immediately himself. It's not that he tried to avoid the consequences. However, he had a legitimate interest to protect. It's the kind of situation which anybody would have heightened emotions, and it's the kind of situation that your officers, I suggest that your officers have very difficult problems in marital relationships because of the pressures that they face. I'm not suggesting that would condone officers to go out and get in people's faces. But it's not inappropriate for him to call and say, look, leave my wife alone. And when he refuses to do it repeatedly, continues to harass and to pester even after his wife has asked, it's not inappropriate for him to meet the person face to face and say, leave my wife alone. That's perfectly permissible under the law. The problem is if you won't do it, the law doesn't provide any kind of remedy. He has no way of stopping that interference under the law. He's left without absolutely anything to do except for go out at high noon and have it out. That's the only remedy the law allows him. You're right, though. It's something that I'm not condoning. Any other questions?
Ms. Dillingham?
So he left his house with the intention of going over to SW's house.
That's correct?
True. And I can speak to being a citizen. When I understand getting angry, I also understand about the increased training that he has. So would you clarify for me, was he in possession of a firearm?
At the time, there's no evidence that he was in. I don't know the answer to the question. There was never any evidence.
Was there one in your car?
I don't, but there was no suggestion that a firearm was involved in any way. He didn't have one with him, is what he's saying.
That's the answer I was looking for. Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to remind post counsel that we really have to go on what is in the record. So if you have questions like that, we're going to have to direct them to post staff, and if we really want the answer to that, we're going to have to remand to staff.
Well, I think what we can say unequivocally is that there was never any suggestion in the record of any sort that a firearm was in his possession or that there was a threatened use of a firearm in any way. Right.
Mr. Crowley.
I have one thing here. Is that officers are held to a higher standard, but we do not hold them to a possible standard. I believe there would be other avenues he could have taken if his wife was being harassed by this guy. Could have called the local law enforcement lawyers of HP. We have happened all the time on the county cop. We can call the assistant. Most of us in my jurisdiction, other cities, highway patrol, if they have issues like that, they refer to us, so it's not a conflict of interest. So there are other avenues. So that's why I've gone on record.
Thank you, Mr. Crowley.
Mr. Chairman,
sure,
I'd also add that they could have pursued something along the lines of a protective order or something like that. But having said that, I'm prepared to make a motion.
Go ahead, Chair.
Okay. I would make the motion that we accept the 2-year suspension for Mr. Timothy K. Jones.
Okay, motion.
Second.
Second by Chief Burbank. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Colonel Fuhrer. Motion passes.
Next case is James Hotelin. The offense is a theft, Category D. Post is recommending a 2-year suspension. On November 18, 2010, Hotelin served a writ of execution and collected $150 from a subject. Hotelin never turned in the return of service for the $150 and never billed the constable's office for the paper service. On November 19, 2010, Hotelin collected $300 bail from a subject on a cash-only bench warrant. Hotelin never turned in the return of service or the $300 and never billed the constable's office for whom he worked for the paper service. When the constable's office asked Hotelin for the $300 bail, he asked for a pay advance in order to turn in the $300. When interviewed, Hotelin could not explain why he did not turn in all of the required documents and the money from the two cases, as he has routinely from other cases. Hotelin did not respond to the notice of agency action, and on November 20th, 2013, the administrative law judge signed an order of default.
Any questions for Director Sparks? Is Mr. Hotelin, or I'm sorry, Sheriff.
Was he, did he have a Garrity hearing that he was placed under Garrity? And
Garrity interview. Alex, would you like to respond to that?
Yes, he was placed under Garrity hearing.
Did he answer truthfully under that Garrity hearing?
He's maintained the entire time that he did not know what he had done with the money. I could not never get him to say definitely that he took it for his own accord or did something with it. It was, I don't know what, if I didn't turn it in, I don't know what. So he maintained that he had turned it in, but he didn't have any documentation to prove that he had turned it in.
Okay, but you have?
I just have a hard time understanding why this falls under a Category D.
That was what we struggled with also, and it was actually presented as a misuse of public monies, I believe, in the beginning, and it would be deemed that it didn't fit that statute. We were supposed to go with the theft statute.
You have two Class B misdemeanors, and if I read the matrix right, as it reads here under the Garrity, it just doesn't fit in the Category B.
Through the interview, we were never able to pinpoint any sort of Garrity violation. Frankly, I have my own suspicions of what happened, but there was never anything that would lead me to say this. In fact, yes, he did lie.
He collected the money. Did he acknowledge that?
He acknowledged that he collected the money, yes.
And the constable's office has no record of him turning it in?
They did not.
So.
And it was only brought up after the other agent went out and talked to the people that he collected from. So he didn't come forth about the money until after he was caught by the other.
That's correct. They had to go to him to discuss why it had not been turned in.
So basically, under what you're saying is under Garrity, defense of, I just don't remember what I did. Even though you can show the money was collected, it was never turned in, so it had to go somewhere, and the public doesn't have it, the office doesn't have it. That's a defense under Garrity to not telling the truth.
It actually says refuses to respond or fails to respond truthfully to questions after having been issued a warning under Garrity. And you didn't feel that he did that.
He answered the questions, however, I don't believe that necessarily that he 100% didn't know what happened to the money. I could not get him to say what happened to the money. We review all these as a staff, and that was the determination that was made.
We did not include Garrity in the notice of agency action, and he did not have the opportunity to respond to that, so it's not a matter of record. We did not review it or feel that we had the clear and convincing evidence to show a Garrity violation before the administrative law judge.
Yeah.
Director Wallentine?
I can quite easily see where the investigator in Post is coming from on the Garrity issue. Based on what you're telling us, he said you may be in a situation where you never get to evidence. Even if we remanded, I don't think you'd ever get to evidence that there was a Garrity violation. Fundamentally, I'm looking at this more as an issue of stealing money, which is one of those things that the Sheriff Edmonds said. This is just one of those areas. Stealing money, protecting people against unlawful force, this is one of those areas that just sets off alarm bells for our guardianship role of our profession. And for that reason, I have a hard time seeing this as a key.
So is it the public monies that increase us to a 2-year suspension versus a theft?
We have two.
Clear on that.
We have two Category D violations, two thefts. Category D baseline is a 1-year suspension. We're recommending 2 years based on the aggravating circumstance that there's multiple incidences.
Let me just make one other comment to the council. It's not just the aggravating circumstance of the repeat offense, but potentially could have had someone locked up, hauled off by another officer, and locked up and put in some. You know, Sheriff Smith, you and I have had the discussion on many times about what happens when someone gets locked in your jail on a Salt Lake or a Tooele warrant. You know, someone could serve some significant time, have their civil liberties significantly impacted because of this officer's conduct. Now, I get it. Because some other officer chose to not arrest the person and look into it, the public was protected. And, you know, hats off to that officer. I think that's an aggravating circumstance that the council should consider as well.
I agree. I don't see any difference between this and an officer making an arrest on the side of the street during the inventory of a vehicle, taking $400 or $500 cash out of their car and pocketing it, right, driving away. It's, circumstances are different, but the end result is the same. Sheriff Edmonds.
You know, it may speak to a bigger issue, too. The presentation I think that we got today on kind of the post-investigatory process, I'm assuming that was done because of some of the statements that I made last time at the post-council meeting. This whole notion that Garrity was violated probably, in my opinion, should have been part of, part of that relevant and pertinent information that we should have. To me, there is no provision under Garrity for a peace officer to feign forgetfulness or be evasive during a Garrity interview. The whole reason they're given that interview is that they cannot be criminally charged. And so therefore, there's an expectation that they're going to be completely honest. If that were the case, if we're allowing provisions for that, then we just, like you said, Chief, we've just given them an out. The easiest way to lie is through omission, not through commission. And if you're just feigning forgetfulness and you're not, how do you not know where $300 went? I've got a real difficult time with that. But the bigger issue to me is that should be something that's part of the agent, or that should be part of the action that we are getting. And again, I'm not comfortable with or satisfied with the way that we are determining what information Post is getting and is not getting, because I believe that is an aggravating factor in this particular case.
I agree.
Now, can I just clarify something? Now, you're talking about using it as like how he answered the questions as an aggravating, or are you asking it in the sense that you think he violated Garrity?
Well, I think at the very least, this is something in my personal opinion, is he did violate Garrity. And I think there's clear and convincing evidence of that, personally. Remember, our evidentiary standard is much less here at the post-council than it would be, again, at a criminal proceeding. To me, that there is sufficient evidence of that.
Yeah, and again, I think this kind of goes back to what Captain Sparks was talking about. This does go through a screening process, and it's up to the post investigators to decide what charges to move forward on. I mean, it's not just screening what charges, but
part of the screening process is determining whether, how confident they feel. It's not like POSTA's trying to shy away from cases that would be difficult to prove, but POSTA's have an obligation to, you know, submit charges that they think is supported by clear and convincing evidence.
Indeed. And I think on this particular case, there is sufficient evidence to in my mind, that there is clear and convincing evidence that there was a Garrity violation. I think it's the whole process, what I'm saying, Mr. Bolander. I really believe this whole process may be fundamentally flawed in how there's a determination made on what POST gets and what we don't get. I'm not overly comfortable with it. It's concerning. I think that there is ample, empirical and anecdotal evidence. And this I would submit that this case would be one of those empirical cases that there's a problem here with what we're being presented and what we're not being presented. Again, we don't know what we don't know.
May I just add, interject here? Whenever we have a case like this, we ask that question. Do we have a Garrity violation? And you may be absolutely right. Feigning omission or feigning a loss of memory may constitute a Garrity violation. But in the end, we have to calculate whether or not we have clear and convincing evidence. What evidence do we present to an ALJ to show that the officer lied under Garrity, as opposed to the fact that the officer may not remember what he did or the reasons for whatever the accusation is. But also point out that we have included in the notice statements that indicate exactly how he answered those questions. So we have included in the notice the facts of how he responded to this question under Garrity. It doesn't reach, in our opinion, it didn't reach a point where we felt comfortable proceeding with clear and convincing evidence for Garrity. And I certainly acknowledge that there may be a wide variety of opinions on that issue. And you may be absolutely right about that issue. It may reach that point. Just in our assessment, it didn't. So because it didn't, we didn't include it as a count in the notice, which means that the officer didn't have the opportunity to respond to the accusation of lying under Garrity. So you may interpret as a counsel from the facts in the case what you interpret and assign aggravating or mitigating factors to those. The officer really didn't have an opportunity to answer directly to whether or not it was lying under Garrity because we didn't feel like we had enough evidence to bring that to the ALJ.
I would submit that we need to be very cautious then, because if that's the case, we've now potentially opened a giant loophole on Garrity interviews. So I think we need to be very, very cautious on that and how we conduct business as it relates to that.
I appreciate that.
Mr. Wallenheim.
I think there's a bridge between the two lines of thinking here. I agree with Sheriff Edmonds that the council needs to be getting as full and robust a picture of the conduct as possible so that the council can make an informed decision. I also happen to agree in this particular case, so just based on the very limited knowledge that we have, that I can see how you may not get to a Garrity violation under clear and convincing, but I can see that in large part because the notice here includes facts that may be broader than we've seen in the past. And so I would just encourage, I think that's a good direction for POST and POST staff to be taking. Share more, when in doubt, share more than less information with the council, because you're right, Deputy Director, there could be 17 opinions around the table as to whether there was a lying by omission or not.
And you need to know that we take notice. We take notice of the discussion that the council has, and
sure
we take notice of that, and are increasing our efforts to make sure we have all of those facts included.
We appreciate that, and I acknowledge that. I do. Thank you.
Just one other point to kind of maybe bring up, and this is probably obvious, this may be obvious to all of you already, but I mean, as far as looking at aggravated mitigating circumstances, what you have the facts, like sure, council members can do that. Obviously, the only chart, the only count on the table here, or the counts, are the ones that were sustained or that they, waived to or defaulted on. I just make the point, just, you can consider facts as aggravating or mitigating. I would caution using it as an aggravating because I think this count should have been in, or instead of this, criminal statute, should have been this criminal statute. Therefore, I'm going to increase the sentence. That makes sense. So, I mean, base the aggravating mitigating on facts, but not on, like, well, I think Garrity should have been charged, so I'm going to increase the suspension. But if you want to
argue, well, the facts here show that they're aggravating circumstances, then use that as your basis for your sanction.
Thank you, Mr. Wallen.
Are you ready for a motion?
I'm ready for a motion.
I was
here.
But, oh, yeah. Did we ask?
Oh, I'm sorry. Is Mr. Hopton here or representative? Sure.
I would move that we set aside the 2-year suspension and make it a 3-year suspension based on the aggravating circumstances directly related to his job, the public trust and confidence that goes into that, and it was multiple counts.
We have a motion for a 3-year.
Second.
Mr. Robinson, any discussion on the motion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Director.
Thank you. The next case is Jason Johnson. The violation is DUI and abuse of psychotoxic chemical solvents, categories C and D, and Post is recommending a 3-year suspension. On August 23rd, 2013, Jason Johnson was driving a state-owned vehicle on a public road while inhaling gas from a compressed gas can used for cleaning. The gas caused Johnson to lose consciousness, which resulted in Johnson crashing the vehicle into a pole on the side of the road. Johnson was not initially arrested, but was later charged with DUI. On November 4th, Johnson pled to impaired driving, a Class B misdemeanor. Johnson waived a hearing before the administrative law judge and stipulated to the facts as contained in the notice of agency action.
Any questions for Deputy Director Sparks? Okay, is Mr. Johnson, our legal representative, here today? Okay, back to the council for a motion.
Move to accept.
Okay, motion to accept by Sheriff Edmonds.
Second.
Seconded by Chief Carpenter. Any discussion on the motion?
Recuse myself from the vote.
Thank you, Mr. Stromberg. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Next case, sir.
The next case is Jared Anderson. Violation is electronic communication harassment and a Garrity violation, category A, and Post is recommending revocation. On February 29th, 2012, a female contacted police reporting someone sent 7 unwanted texts to her cell phone containing sexually explicit language. The victim said she found the texts very offensive and wanted the incident investigated. Police department initiated a criminal investigation and determined Jared Anderson was the owner of the cell phone number associated with sexually explicit text messages. On March 5, 2013, the female received additional sexually explicit texts, including the image of male genitalia. Anderson was charged with 1 count, electronic communication harassment, a Class B misdemeanor. Anderson entered into a plea in abeyance to the charge. In 2 separate Garrity interviews conducted by the Department of Corrections, Anderson lied and refused to answer questions related to their administrative investigation. Anderson refused to participate in the post-investigative process. Anderson did not respond to the notice of agency action, and on November 7, 2013, an order of default was signed by the administrative law judge.
Do you know why there were 2 Garrity interviews?
I believe it was just part of their investigative process. They did an initial interview and a follow-up interview.
Okay. I see a little... Hold on a minute, Lieutenant. I see a little comparison here with the previous case. During the initial Garrity, somebody denies sending the pictures, even though we have forensic evidence that proves otherwise. The last case we had... monies that were collected, and somebody denies that they know what, or they just don't remember what. So I just think this illustrates how we really need to look at these, not only the denials, but the omissions during these investigations and really zero in on those as we move this through the process, Director. Lieutenant Acosta, I'm sorry.
One of the second interview
UDC contact with this individual and attempted to get information relating to witnesses, because this individual was claiming that it wasn't his genitalia, it was friends who had sent this information. When UDC attempted to get the information to go interview the witnesses, he refused and just basically told them that he wasn't going to cooperate any longer. And that was the purpose of the second interview.
Thank you.
Highlighting the difference between the two cases, with this one we had just a simple refusal to answer questions.
On the second one.
On the second, yeah.
And the first one we did. And that's, I'm only comparing the first one, not the second one.
So I'm sorry, I thought you were comparing the previous case.
I am comparing it to the, I'm comparing the first one done on June 27th, 2012 by UDC with the case we just previously heard. So. All right, any further questions of Deputy Director Sparks? Is Mr. Anderson or a representative here today?
No.
Bring it back to the council for a motion. Motion to accept, Mr. Crowley, with a second.
Second.
Ms. Bellingham, please, Sheriff. All in favor? Any discussion on the motion? Mr. Strong will too recuse himself. Any discussion on the motion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you, Director Sparks.
One more thing, if I may. There was one additional case that was sent out in the original mailing. We determined that there was a procedural issue with the notice that was provided of the date of this council meeting, and so that case was not ready to be presented at the council. It will be presented in the next meeting.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next item of business is quarterly report. Lieutenant Brewer.
Council members, the purpose for these quarterly reports are to provide you a little bit of a snapshot of what's going on in between these post-council meetings. Since we only get to meet with you four times a year, this gives you just a little bit of an idea of what's going on in between. So regarding in-service training, Post provided 20 classes for a total of 244 hours, and that includes online training as well, to 146 students. And I say students because Post provides training not to just sworn personnel, but to non-sworn personnel such as dispatchers and people that work at port of entry. For instance, they take intoxilizer trainings and things like that. Some of the courses that we provide are basic radar and recertification, patrol rifle instructor, intoxilizer certification and recertification, instructor development, field training officer, post supervisor leadership course, crime scene academy, employee discipline and administrative procedures, defensive tactics instructor class, and impact weapon instructor class. Those were all of the titles of courses that were provided this last quarter. And for your information, we did cancel one emergency vehicle instructor course due to the cost of that course. As Director Stevenson reported last meeting, we did have a budget constraint going on right now, and that is a very expensive class to put on, well over $10,000 in instructor fees. So we felt like if we could just hold off for a little while until next month or till next quarter and see where our budget is. In the basic training, Post has had two classes in session, sessions 304 and 305. Just graduated class 304 last week, and we'll be graduating post session 305 on December 19th. And 304 graduated 22 cadets. 21 cadets were eligible to graduate. We did have one that was not eligible to graduate. However, they still may be able to be eligible to certify after they pass their firearms. They have 30 days to do that. And so the total numbers for post last quarter, we certified 24 SFO officers and 51 law enforcement certifications. Now that is just post. That does not include satellite numbers. Obviously statewide those numbers are considerably higher. Any questions regarding the training numbers we provided or training courses that we are providing? Okay, thank you.
There,
yes, sir.
There was discussion about additional courses for first line and mid-management being in the pipeline with a little more availability.
Statewide?
What progress has been made? Yes, statewide.
Do you know what regions where the discussion was? I wasn't sure of any current need for that. We try to maintain a very close communication with the region coordinators, and if there is a need to have it in an area, we'll host it. So, for instance, in this supervisory course, leadership course that we just hosted, that was down in St. George in October. You know, that's something we can definitely look at. If you Chief, know of an area or a course that's needed in a certain area, we'll make every effort we can to bring it to that area.
All right. Thank you, Lieutenant.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Acosta.
Lieutenant Acosta, you're next.
Thank you. Thank you, Council members. As you all know, I'm the Bureau Chief of Investigations, and I wanted to let you know exactly what we've been doing since the last post-council meeting. Our office has received a total of 27 complaints from agencies. We have opened 10 investigations so far. We have conducted 2 ALJ hearings, and we have also closed 1 case with no action following the investigation. That means that we conducted, there was nothing to the investigation, so it was closed out, no action. We have received 2 voluntary relinquishments. Those relinquishments are related to BCI violations, sexual misconduct, and firearms violations, as well as aggravated assault and obstruction of justice. So these are people that just didn't want to go any further with the investigation. Our office has conducted 97 background investigations for people who have attended all of the academies, to include the ones here at Post, the UDC personnel, as well as satellite personnel that have that we've done. Currently, we have 65 open investigations that are actively involved, and we have 105 open investigations where we're waiting for some kind of response back from the individual officers, waiting for whether they're going to do a hearing waiver, ask for an ALJ hearing, or make a decision whether they're going to move forward with a voluntary relinquishment. So that's where our office is at right now. Any questions from investigations? And just to let you know, everything that you're concerned with, we will be addressing, and hopefully we'll have an answer for you by the next council meeting or prior to. Yes, sir.
I just noticed in this last packet there was a couple of this back in 2012. We got some cases open that are quite old cases.
Older cases. There are some cases that are a bit older. If you look at the Hotelin investigation, part of our investigation was waiting for the criminal process to run its course, to determine if he was going to be charged or if he wasn't going to be charged. So we were waiting for that. And then, of course, trying to get him to get in here and talk to us was a little difficult. First, he just didn't want to talk, and then other times he was saying that, well, I need to speak to counsel. So we do have some cases that are a little bit older, and hopefully we're trying to move those forward as fast as we can.
So there's not a lot of them?
There's just a few that are out there, and I'm sure that... I think the 11 cases may be completed now. I'm not positive, and I have to look at my logs to verify that. But I know we'll have some 2012 cases that are still out there. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you,
Lieutenant Acosta. Okay, schedule of our next meeting, which I assume will be in conjunction with the Chief's Conference in St. George in March on the 27th, which is a Thursday, after the roundtable discussion that's usually held at the Purgatory Correctional Facility. Is that correct, Kelly?
I believe so.
Okay. 27th of March. Traditionally, we've held this at the university campus, so I assume that's where we'll be going again.
Yeah, we will let you know for sure. There may be a change in the venue. We will probably do what we've done in the past and have lunch prior to the meeting, with the meeting starting.
Any other matters of business or discussion the council would like to bring forward before we close the meeting? No, okay. Donna, Robbie, I'd like to thank you for your years of service to the Post Council and the citizens of the state of Utah and law enforcement as a professional. We have truly valued your input and your wisdom as we've deliberated these cases. So thank you very much. With that, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved. Second.
Okay.